It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a congressional committee investigating the January 6th insurrection wants to see documents from the Trump administration, but former President Trump says they're protected by executive privilege. We'll take a closer look at the claims and find out what's covered by executive privilege and what isn't. First, school boards around the country are finding themselves in the middle of controversy and sometimes heated debates. Among them are mask mandates and other COVID policies, race, and sexuality. Wisconsin is a big flashpoint for these conversations. For example, in Waukesha, the school district says it believes in diversity and individual differences, but the school board there has since banned certain classroom displays like Black Lives Matter posters or rainbow flags because they say they're political and encourage advocacy. Since the pandemic began, angry parents have shown up at school board meetings to express their displeasure with their kids' learning environments. Some ran for school board, some won. In fact, Wisconsin's attempted more recalls of school board members during the pandemic than every other state except California. Around the country, thousands of school board seats will be up for grabs next month, and Wisconsin school board elections are held in spring. Meanwhile, some are worried that the conservative push is undoing some key supports for underrepresented students. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is the story in your community, in the schools around you? Do you generally think your local school board gets things right or wrong? Have you become more engaged with your kids' education during the pandemic? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Aaron Richards is a Milwaukee-based national education reporter at USA Today. Aaron, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks.
We see headlines about one school or another again and again. You've been following this issue closely, Aaron. How widespread are these flare-ups around school boards around the country?
Well, it's quite widespread because we've seen a lot of flare-ups politically around everything else tied to COVID as well, and schools are in the middle of that. So a lot of this parents watching their kids at home on Zoom and knowing more about what their kids were learning or maybe not learning. School boards became the place where people could go and talk publicly about whether they felt that schools should be open or closed, if masks should be used or not. So many, the school board meetings were on Zoom for so much of the pandemic that it made it easier for people to just jump online and participate. And of course, those have escalated now. Many more meetings have been in person. The COVID rules have activated a number of parents. And then in the middle of all this, we started to hear more about critical race theory, which we can get into that a little bit more. It's a legal term to look at the influence of racism in society and embedded in institutions. And there's strong feelings on the conservative side that this isn't something that actually happens in real life, and they don't want K-12 schools to be teaching that. K-12 schools really don't teach that theory specifically, but they do and have been for years moving toward more practices that research and experts say are good to make kids feel included in schools. So that's where some of the push now with parents getting riled up about COVID protocols and then about critical race theory. And now some of these changes are happening because parents, many of them conservative, have run for the board, they've gotten on, and now they have power to make real changes. And it's you can make changes much faster at the local level in your school board than you sometimes can, at the state and certainly at the federal level.
Let's talk about critical race theory, the rise of this as a buzzword in these protests against schools. Is this something that spontaneously arose one district at a time, or was there a coordinated effort to bring this out as an issue?
We really saw this explode when a couple of conservative organizations and one guy in particular named Chris Rufo, who's now at the Manhattan Institute, started coming up with examples of what he thought was critical race theory happening in schools. And, there have been lots of news articles about the wrong way to teach about racism, for example, slave trade recreations in school and whatnot. Those are not seen as good steps to teach kids how to understand race and racism in America. But really, the push started when this particular author, Chris Rufo, was coming up with examples of this and saying that this was embedded in all the institutions of the federal government. Fox News put a big spotlight on it near the end of Trump's presidency. And former President Donald Trump had basically said that all federal contractors were no longer required or could no longer be forced to do diversity and equity training, which is something pretty common in workplaces and in schools, has been for years. But that really kind of triggered the backlash. This was also coinciding with the backlash to the New York Times 1619 project, which retold the history of America through the lens of slavery and its impact on American institutions. So this has really been snowballing, and then it's come together with all of these agitations around COVID protocols, which are also can be very politically polarizing, even though science is sort of getting lost in the middle sometimes. And so it's really kind of coalesced into real changes now, because you can get on your school board, you can run pretty easily, and you can make a lot of impact at your local level. And that's what a lot of these parents are doing now. And there is a feeling on the right that their views are underrepresented in schools, and that schools shouldn't be discussing things like gender and sexuality and recognizing that or celebrating it. And so it's become as much of a culture clash between different points of political view on this as it has about, you know, good teaching and learning and practices.
Talking to Aaron Richards, national education reporter for USA Today, looking at controversies facing school boards on issues of how race and American history should be taught over COVID, mask mandates, and more. Recalls going on here in Wisconsin, in school boards, elsewhere in the country as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you on a school board? What kind of things are you seeing? Is it getting heated from time to time? What do you think about the issues that are generating this controversy? How we teach about race, the mask mandates in schools, distance learning, and things like that. Do you think your local school board got it right or wrong, or as right as they could under the circumstances? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Aaron, recalls. We've got some coming up or efforts underway in Wisconsin. We see some elsewhere in the country. What kind of things are you seeing?
Right. Well, one of the biggest and most highly watched ones is a recall campaign in the Mequon-Thiensville School District, which, of course, is just north of Milwaukee. There are a number of suburban moms who have been activated by both the critical race theory debates and wanting to have more of a conservative representation on their board, and they've gathered enough signatures to force a recall election. Most school board elections are in the spring in Wisconsin. And these moms are very passionate about what they're doing. I went to one of their presentations in Milwaukee in September, and there is some misinformation about what they think is happening in their schools. I know that there's some talk about Mequon scores dropping for students. Mequon-Thiensville is still one of the highest performing school districts in the state. It's highly desirable to be in that district and to go to that high school. So I'm not clear on exactly what they hope would get a whole lot better in Mequon-Thiensville, but they've certainly activated a lot of their community members, and they feel like their voices need to be heard on the board. So it's very interesting, because it's very much a microcosm of Wisconsin's split politics. We are a swing state, and this is really playing out in these local school board elections. And it could be a harbinger. Maybe this is the moment where Republicans do have a lot more energy and can sort of win at these local levels and then take that energy to win statewide and national elections and midterms.
And at least some of these cases, including, I think, in Mequon-Thiensville, Republican political action committees are helping fund the recall efforts. And I believe yes. A Republican candidate for governor was recruiting some of those local candidates. Do I have that right?
Yes, there has been, of course, the interplay between the national political groups and the state political groups. The folks in Mequon do have help from some of the political operatives, which, of course, gives you a leg up in just running against your average parent. But there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. Mm-hmm. It just means that there's more energy there than we've ever really seen before. Or lately in these, you know, otherwise fairly sleepy school board elections.
We're talking about how school boards around the country are dealing with controversial issues in recent weeks and months. Aaron Richards is with us, national education reporter for USA Today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you paying attention to the school board in your community, maybe more so than you did in years past? Have there been heated, controversial moments, or are things working smoothly where you are? If you're on a school board, what are you seeing? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. The conversation continues. We'll hear from some of you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about controversies facing school boards around the country, including here in Wisconsin, with decisions on masks, how to teach race and history, and more. Protests in some cases, recall elections in others. Aaron Richards is with us, national education reporter for USA Today, based in Milwaukee. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Laura is with us in Manitowoc. Laura, hi.
Hi, I'm calling in because I've been paying close attention to this in my community. I'm not on a school board, but I've been observing the meetings and seeing, you know, the anti-CRT signs pop up around town and seeing neighbors really being, turning against their own neighbors. And I just want to add to this conversation the fact that, you know, in these small communities, much of this hysteria over, you know, the anti-masking or the masking and the anti-CRT is coming from outside the community. And I'm not just talking about people from other communities, you know, coming in the night of the school board meeting and causing disruption, though that is indeed happening. But, for example, in Manitowoc, the local Republicans have been inviting this Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, which is the organization that dismantled the teachers union on behalf of Scott Walker. Those lawyers have been coming in, you know, they'll set up at a local hotel upon invitation by the local Republicans, and all the local Republicans will attend these meetings where these lawyers just really whip up the crowd, and they say the most outlandish things, and the people that are attending believe this. For example, at the last meeting, the attorney that was presenting said, you know, you need to stop these liberal teachers. He actually handed out a form that parents can use to hand out to the teachers. And this form is designed to intimidate the teachers, and what it asks is for the teacher to report back to the parent anytime they teach on any one of the catch terms, you know, equity or equality or anything like that, that the right has identified as CRT terminology. And the lawyer said, the reason you want the teachers to fill this paperwork out is so you can identify who the liberal teachers are and stop them, because they are injecting young girls with testosterone and forcing young girls to have abortions. He said that literally in those words. So,
Laura,
so,
thanks for the call. So Laura is seeing this. Aaron, are we seeing this kind of coordinated effort? I don't know about the specific claim toward the end there, but is this something that is happening in a lot of communities?
We have seen a number of high-powered conservative organizations guide parents on this topic. The Heritage Foundation, for example, has a toolkit to be a woke parent, but it's kind of in quotes. And it's, you know, it's how to file records requests and how to ask if your school is teaching CRT. To the caller's point about the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, Will is located in Milwaukee. They're funded by the Bradley Foundation, and they have a very conservative viewpoint. And they exist to essentially file and fight lawsuits that are in the conservative causes. So that's why they're very keyed into this right now. And it is effective. I don't know if there's an equivalent liberal law team that's quite as prevalent as they are, but they've been around for a long time. They file a lot of lawsuits around schools issues and school choice issues. So in broad strokes, though, there is a lot of coordination both between state organizations like this that are conservative and the national conservative organizations, in part because there's a lot of emotion here, and there's a lot, there's probably voters that may be on the fence that would be compelled to agree with the Republicans on this. So there is a lot of strategy and coordination. Nothing illegal about it, but some of the messaging is not always accurate either.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Christopher now in Kenosha. Christopher, hi.
Hello. I just had a question about critical race theory and teaching it in schools, and how I think it should be a requirement, and how I don't really understand why it's opposed so much. Humans have evolved to recognize patterns and make predictions, And if we just turn a blind eye as to what the circumstances are that have produced, you know, these underprivileged neighborhoods that are, you know, have high concentrations of minorities due to redlining and other systemic issues, and just leave it up to people to, you know, come to their own conclusions, they're going to find a pattern, and that pattern is going to be minority or black person, or violence, so forth.
Christopher, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. A little hard to make it out, Aaron, but Christopher talking about how to teach about these issues. You did a whole piece actually on how schools typically try to and the recommendations for how to teach about historical issues of racial inequality, like redlining, as our caller mentioned. What kind of things did you hear from experts?
Right. So they actually say that good teaching about racism and racism in the United States does include voices from people who were enslaved and voices from people who are not just the white majority. That is part of what's driving some of the controversy, is that many conservatives or people who liked the traditional text feel like the white narrative is being crowded out a bit by more diverse voices. There's lots of people that say that's a good thing, including education researchers, because we're always learning more about history and we're always trying to gather more information from different sides about how it felt and how it played out for different types of people. And to the caller's point too about making critical race theory a requirement, there is a number of people on the left that think that there should be a bigger pushback to this, to say, yes, like we do have racism embedded in institutions. Now, again, many conservatives don't believe that. They believe that racism exists, but not that it's embedded in an institution in a baked in way. We did some polling at USA Today this fall, back to school polling. And what was interesting is that 2 out of 3 parents overall actually believe that schools should teach the ongoing effects of racism in America, the ongoing effects of slavery, what's still lingering from that time that affects society today. That's really what critical race theory is. But if you ask parents, well, do you think it's okay to teach about critical race theory? Then it drops down to about 50% of parents. So some of this is just the messaging around this, that term has a lot of kind of negative overtones to it. So it tends to get people riled up. But most parents in our polling believe that we should be talking about the ongoing effects of slavery. And we've certainly done lots of stories that, our paper and others that say, you know, the black family that tries to sell their house and their photos are, of their family, they get a much lower offer much lower appraisal price than when they took all their neighbors' family photos, and their neighbors are white, they hang those up instead, and then they get a much higher offer. So again, to the caller's point, research is pretty strong that people do have some individual biases, but there is a lot of resistance on the right to the assertion that, you know, we are inherently a racist society.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Aaron Richards, education reporter for USA Today, about controversies facing school boards. Back to your calls now. Scott is with us in Menominee. Scott, hi.
Hi. I was just going to make a point. I think previous callers kind of hit on a lot of things. But then here out in Menominee, we had a controversy with the book that was discussed in one of the schools was I Am Malala. And, of course, you know, that includes somebody that was, I think, Malala or was a Muslim. And that got quite a lot of attention from the local, you know, Republicans, basically. But, yeah, the coordination, I do have a lot of concern that it's kind of scary, because it doesn't seem like it's just a general grassroots thing. When you got people with yard signs under their Trump signs, they've got their unmask their our kids signs and such things as that going on.
Scott, thanks for the call. He mentioned a Malala book. Aaron, anecdotally, I've seen children's books about Rosa Parks or Martin Luther King blocked at least temporarily from schools. Children's book authors' speeches canceled. A principal fired in Texas, I think it was, over accusations that he had violated the state's guidelines on teaching about race. Are we seeing this affect what and who kids see in their schools?
Right. And to this point too, there's been a big resurgence in book banning and parents kind of looking at some of the literature in their kids' libraries or the school libraries and thinking that they're too explicit. This often happens around books that have themes of queerness or gay and lesbian themes. There are some heated feelings about that. But in other cases, it does seem like it's gotten a little bit out of hand. There's a school board in Central York up in Pennsylvania that had banned a list of books by Black authors and other minority voices and other resources. For a year, students weren't supposed to be using these resources. And I think one of them included the book Hidden Figures, which was a very popular movie about women that contributed essentially to the space race, whose narratives hadn't been told. And so I think that there's a lot of, again, there's lots of organizing around parent Facebook groups for this, conservative parent groups. There's, I interviewed a guy for this last story who said, look, a lot of this is coming out of QAnon chat rooms because QAnon has now become much more mainstream. It's kind of become part of the conservative ideology. And so a lot of these ideas are shared quickly, and we're seeing these same things at school boards around the country because there's a lot more coordination and talking online. Many of us aren't completely back to our full outside the house lives yet. So there's been plenty of time for people to kind of, read about what's happening elsewhere and follow the same pattern in their local school district.
In just our last half a minute or so, Aaron, what are you watching for next on this story you've been following so closely?
Yeah, I'm doing a follow-up piece that tries to highlight kid voices about what, for example, taking down signage in the classroom that's inclusive. What does that mean? What does that mean for you and your learning experience? Does that change the teachers you approach? Does it make you feel less safe in school? Really trying to highlight those because I think what's really been lost in this entire debate is how kids feel. And some of the testimony at school board meetings that it comes from middle school and high school students is very compelling. And I think that we need to all be listening a little bit more to them sometimes and not get quite as wrapped up in some of our adult political battles.
Aaron, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Aaron Richards is a national education reporter for USA Today based in Milwaukee. We talked to her about the many controversies facing school boards in Wisconsin and around the country, including mask mandates and other COVID measures, sexuality, and the teaching of race and history. Coming up after the news, former President Donald Trump is fighting an attempt by lawmakers to investigate the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol, citing executive privilege. We'll talk to a legal expert about how that secrecy power works for presidents of the United States and what its limitations are. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a consumer travel advocate says the federal government has allowed U.S. airlines to get away with major lapses in customer service this year. We'll get suggestions on how to improve air travel, and you can share your stories of good or bad flying experiences. First, in northern Wisconsin, loggers who have been in the industry for decades say they're experiencing one of the worst markets they've seen. Paper mill closures have led to a big drop in timber prices that's now lasted for more than a year. As Rob Mentzer reports, that's threatening the livelihoods of many forest professionals.
There's a wall of hardwood stacked up here at Dennis Shenick's northern Wisconsin logging site. The mechanized arm of the harvester measures and cuts the timber. Haulers will take it to paper mills, which will turn it into pulp. There are still mills that buy this wood, but loggers like Shenick say these are some of the hardest times his industry has seen.
The mills are full. They're flush. And they know it. And they know there's more power, horsepower out here to produce wood than what they need. So they can literally set our price.
Prices crashed in mid-2020 after the Ohio-based company Verso announced it would stop production at its massive Wisconsin Rapids paper mill. That mill was the region's largest buyer. Without it, there's a glut of pulpwood on the market, driving prices down. It's also driving some loggers out of the business.
There's guys dropping out now. For me, I even wonder, it's like, do we keep wearing this equipment out just to make our payments?
He's talking about payments on heavy equipment like the harvester. Like all loggers, Shenick has been scrambling to cut costs and control his losses.
There's no profit anymore. The profit is gone. Like always, we keep getting kicked down the road, and we keep trying to survive. That's the nature of our beast.
Logging, hauling, and forestry employs some 64,000 people in Wisconsin. And for many, it's a family tradition spanning generations. The Northwoods relies on logging to make forests usable for recreation and to help protect them from invasive species and fires. Now, some loggers are quitting. Some have taken side jobs in construction, The rest are holding out hope that the Verso Mill will reopen one day soon.
It's not just the local community of Wisconsin Rapids. It's not just the people that work in that mill, but the ripple effect is enormous.
That's Rebecca Ludke. She's the director of the Wisconsin County Forests Association. She says some Northwoods counties rely on revenues from forest management to fund public services. About 20% of the wood Verso bought came from county forests.
When you take 20% of the wood completely out of the picture, there's going to be a gap, right, that needs to be filled.
Last year, a loggers group formed a nonprofit cooperative with the goal of buying and operating the Verso Mill. The idea had enthusiastic support within the timber industry and among politicians from both parties. But according to people involved in discussions, Verso itself was always lukewarm to it. This summer, an attempt to boost the cooperative with $65 million in state loans failed after Democrats and Republicans couldn't agree on how to pay for it. Industry analysts say it might not have made a difference anyway. Verso's share price today is well above where it was before the pandemic. Paul Fowler is director of the Wisconsin Institute for Sustainable Technology. He says he expects that the Wisconsin Rapids Mill will eventually sell, but Verso has no particular incentive to hurry.
Aside from how it looks to the communities in which they've operated and idled mills, they're probably sitting in a good position.
But that position leaves the Wisconsin timber industry and the communities that rely on it hanging in the balance. Henry Schinnebeck is the director of the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association.
To them, it's just a line on a piece of paper. But for us, it's not just a line on a piece of paper. It's everybody's life.
In July, a private equity firm that operates several paper mills offered to buy Verso. Late last month, Verso told shareholders that deal was only possible if the firm, quote, meaningfully increased its offer. For loggers like Schenick, that means more waiting. And the longer the Wisconsin Rapids Mill sits idle, the more lasting the effects will be. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, a congressional committee investigating the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol is moving to get documents and testimony from former President Donald Trump and his advisors. In a lawsuit filed Monday, Trump argues that many of those records are shielded by executive privilege, a protection that lets administrations keep at least some of their records and communications private, and that's been used as far back as George Washington. We're taking a closer look now at executive privilege, how it works, what it covers, and what it does not. You can join in at 800-642-1234. In general, how transparent should presidents and their advisors be? How much access should the public have to their internal communications? How about ex-presidents? How much should they be allowed to keep secret? And do you see this investigation by this House committee on January 6th and then the events leading up to it important enough to justify more access to that kind of communication? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science at law and law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me again. My pleasure.
Can you give us the 101 on executive privilege? Why do we have it? What does it do?
Okay, what executive privilege is basically grounded in the concept of separation of powers. You know, each branch of government, executive, legislative, judicial, has certain powers that they have. And what the Supreme Court has said, and the most famous case about this is U.S. versus Nixon, which was all about Nixon's, you know, tape conversations at the White House. What the court has said is that executive privilege does exist. It's kind of a protection for privileged conversations that the president and the executive branch may need to have in order to what? To do their job. So the court said in U.S. versus Nixon that executive privilege exists. However, what the court said, it's not absolute. And in many cases, the court has said that executive privilege may need to give way to what needs of a criminal investigation. And that was the court in U.S. versus Nixon, may need to give way to criminal investigations or efforts to try to understand if there's been what wrongdoing in the executive branch. So again, basic concept, executive privilege is an idea of giving some privileged communications to the White House and the president. However, In many cases, as the court has said, it may have to give to other important needs.
Now, if I search for the phrase executive privilege in the Constitution, correct me if I'm wrong, I won't find it there. But as you were saying, it derives from that separation of powers, and it came up as a concept, not necessarily with those exact words, under our first president. So this does go way back.
It does go way back. Okay, the way that we would find executive privilege found in the Constitution will be what we call the vesting clauses. Article 1, Section 1 vests legislative power in the House and Senate. Article 2, Section 1 says executive power vested in the president. Article 3, Section 1 vests judicial power in the Supreme Court et al. So it's in the concept of the vesting clauses for our purposes. Article 2, Section 1, where executive privilege is located, and you're absolutely correct. It goes all the way back to George Washington saying that there's certain things that take place within the executive branch that the other branches of government should not have privy to. They should not be able to sort of get that information. Again, the idea being that a president should enjoy the confidence of his staff that certain communications may not be revealed to others for fear that what? If they knew they were going to be revealed, they might not be quite as candid with the president in terms of advice.
We are talking about executive privilege, what it is, what it does, how it applies to the January 6th commission. David Schultz is with us from Hamline University and the University of Minnesota. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions, or email ideas at WPR.org. David, let's take it to that January 6th committee. I said commission. It's a committee. But the issues coming up now, they have subpoenas. For somebody like Steve Bannon, they're looking for documents. This committee is. President Trump says, nope, executive privilege, you don't get access to it. Can you look at the argument, first of all, from the former president about why executive privilege, he says, should apply here?
Well, from the former president's position would be that what? We'll take the concept of executive privilege and say that what? He was gathering information from his advisors or saying things to his advisors under the belief that this would not be disclosed to the public. And again, there's a sense of candidness there. I think that's part of the argument. Second, I think he wants to implicitly argue that disclosing this information to Congress would violate, again, his right as a president, as well as a chief executive. Now, I suspect he might try to make some other arguments here also, but that's going to be the core argument that he as president, as when he was president, he might not have had to have been able to turn this material over to Congress. But now as ex-president, he should still have that same right.
One of the arguments against that, as I understand it, David, is executive privilege is supposed to apply to their duties as president. This committee could say, well, hold on. It's not your duty as president to try to overturn the results of the election so you could stay president. That's outside of what should be covered by executive privilege. Is there a valid argument there?
A little bit, but I think there's a couple of stronger arguments. Again, I want to go back to U.S. versus Nixon, where the Supreme Court said we have to weigh the competing needs of executive privilege and the right of confidentiality against, at least in that case, it was what, a subpoena being issued and the needs of the criminal justice process to do its job. Here, you can make the argument and say we have to weigh the scales between what the president's privilege is, or I'm going to say ex-president's privileges versus congressional needs. The second thing that I think is very important here to understand, remember, he's the ex-president of the United States, not the current president. Once he stepped out of office, he may no longer be able to claim executive privilege. It is now up to Joe Biden to claim executive privilege since he's the person who's in possession of those documents. And much in the same way, for example, if you're in a private business, a private corporation, if a CEO leaves and is replaced by another CEO, the new CEO can basically release conversations that took place involving the previous one. So same thing here. I think Trump has a difficult road ahead of him, not impossible, but to say that as an ex-president, he gets to invoke executive privilege. I think it's the privilege of Joe Biden to invoke, and whether or not he wants to release the information about the presidency, including the ex-president, to Congress.
We're talking to David Schultz, professor of political science and law at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's with us for a look at executive privilege, how it works, its limitations, and how it applies to the House January 6th committee, looking for information from the previous Trump administration, legal challenges from that administration. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Should, for example, the former president be forced to share documents and communication about January 6th, or should the National Archives be required to release those to the Congressional Committee? Are the things you think presidents should be allowed to keep secret? What fits into that category? What questions do you have about how this all works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our look at former President Donald Trump's claims of executive privilege in the investigation into January 6th and the planning that went into it. David Schultz stays with us from Hamline University and the University of Minnesota. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have general thoughts or questions about executive privilege and how it works, or specific ones about how it relates to the January 6th investigation, you can join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to what we heard from the House Select Committee investigating January 6th this week. This is Republican Representative Liz Cheney, one of two Republicans on the commission, talking about Steve Bannon and former President Trump's executive privilege claims.
Mr. Bannon's and Mr. Trump's privilege arguments do, however, appear to reveal one thing. They suggest that President Trump was personally involved in the planning and execution of January 6th. And this committee will get to the bottom of that.
So Representative Cheney saying the refusal to testify these executive privilege claims maybe indicate the kind of behavior that the committee is looking for. What do you think of that argument?
I'm always hesitant to say that somebody not wanting to say something is proof of guilt. Remember, at one time during the 1950s, when people were invoking their Fifth Amendment rights not to testify before the McCarthy hearings, that was tantamount to guilt. So I'm not willing to go quite that far. I'm willing to give, let's say, President Trump the benefit of the doubt and say that he's making a sincere argument to say that I don't believe this information should be released because what? Because as president of the United States, it was protected and shielded by the Constitution. Now Liz Cheney, Representative Cheney, may be making a good political argument. She may be suggesting that what? That the stuff implicates him. And in that sense, I think when I listened to her, she was drawing a parallel, I think, to U.S. versus Nixon, where with Nixon, the tapes did eventually reveal his complicity, his direction in terms of many things. I think she's hinting at that. We don't know. And I think part of the commission, I guess commission or committee, I forgot what it is also, committee that's looking into this, that's what they're trying to figure out. I hate to use the phrase here, but I'll use it. What did Trump know and when did he know it and what involvement did he have in it? I think that's what she's alluding to.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Gary is with us in Iron River. Hi, Gary.
Hi, good afternoon, folks. I'm putting all the politics aside. It seems to me if you accept the concept of executive privilege's purpose to ensure candid and confidential conversations happen, the timing of when they're disclosed doesn't matter. Whether you disclose them when the administration is in power or after the administration leaves, it's going to serve to tamp down the willingness of any people in an administration in power to speak that way for fear that it all could be disclosed once they're gone.
Gary, thanks for the call. Interesting point, and that would point, David, toward the argument that, yeah, ex-presidents should be better covered with executive privilege because if you're worried about a conversation coming out now, you might be worried about it in 3 years.
I think it's a very good point here. I mean, again, I think if we looked at executive privilege in an absolute, just kind of like in a glass jar by itself, I think that's an exceedingly good argument to make. But again, for good or for bad, the U.S. Supreme Court has said, we have to look at it in terms of other competing objectives. And I'm going to also argue that we saw in another famous case, Nixon versus Administrator of General Services, which is also a case about taking the presidential papers and information and giving them to the National Archive, is that the court has said there may be a point that also in the interest of history, in the interest of disclosure, for people who have a right to know about what their government is doing, that at some point we weigh executive privilege with the right of the public to know, and how does it balance out? And so at the end of the day, we're looking at here, you know, many competing, you know, values. And the courts so far, again, between Nixon versus General Services, U.S. versus Nixon, have weighed on the side of what? Disclosure, and not on the side of concealment.
Thanks for that call. I want to get into one specific angle here, David. Steve Bannon formerly had a White House position back in 2017. This committee wants him to testify. He says no. They're issuing a subpoena. President Trump says executive privilege. These, all my former people, don't have to testify. But at the point of now and in early January, Steve Bannon wasn't an official. He was a guy. Does executive privilege apply to him?
No, it doesn't. And even if he were a government official at that time, it's not clear that if executive privilege extends beyond what? The president of the United States. I know in one of my classes, I talk about this, that the court has said clearly presidents have executive privilege. Maybe there's something in terms of maybe a vice president or something tighter like that. But the courts have generally said that this is really something surrounding the president of the United States, and they've been hesitant to expand it beyond that person or that office. And so I think, again, it's going to be very hard, not impossible, but very hard given the existing law for Steve Bannon and other White House officials to be able to invoke executive privilege for not testifying. Now, could they invoke potentially a Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination? Yes, but I think it's relatively, at least right now with the existing law, unlikely that the executive privilege argument applies to them or would be applicable here.
Let's go back to our callers now. Bruce is with us in Cumberland. Bruce, hi.
Hi. I just remember a time where Donald Trump had said, and I quote, anyone who pleads the Fifth Amendment is guilty. And so by him constructing that argument, and saying that there is weight to that argument, then for him to plead the Fifth or take executive privilege, which is presidential confidentiality, and it could be the case that it's not to incriminate himself.
Bruce, thanks for the call. What do you think, David?
Well, I don't know, you know, and I'll take the reader for truth there that at some point Donald Trump said that about the Fifth Amendment. I don't recall it myself.
I just pulled it up. He did say that at some point early in his presidency.
Okay, fair enough. I just wanted to be sure. Okay, but assuming he did say that there, again, I'm you know, personally hesitant, and I think the law ought to be hesitant in terms of saying that invoking your constitutional rights is tantamount, you know, to guilt or acknowledgement of guilt. We may reach inferences of that, but from a constitutional perspective, if we're saying that we live in a society of presumption of innocence and the government bears the burden to prove guilt, we probably can't hold that view, even if many of us, I think, secretly suspect that he might be hiding something. I'm not saying I do, but many people do.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute, David, what are you watching for next in this installment in the saga of executive privilege?
Well, what I'm going to be looking to see at this point, a couple different things. Obviously, we're going to look to see what the Justice Department does now with Steve Bannon. If I remember correctly, late this afternoon, the House voted for contempt of holding Bannon in contempt. So that's going to unfurl. And then we're going to see a court hearing at this point also regarding Donald Trump's claims. And I think what I'm going to look at is to see is what? How they affect those trade-offs. Do they say that an ex-president, a person no longer in office, can they invoke executive privilege? If so, that's a pretty significant extension of executive privilege compared to what we think it is right now.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you to all the listeners.
We've been talking to David Schultz. He's a professor of political science and law at Hamline University, also professor of law at the University of Minnesota. We've been talking about the concept of executive privilege, the origins of it in American constitutional law, what it means for a president and a president's staff and their ability to not disclose certain information about their internal communications to Congress, and where the limits are, plus how it applies to the January 6th committee in the House, their investigations, and their subpoena efforts. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, find out how some farmers are working to prevent climate change in Wisconsin and beyond. That and more. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. I've mentioned on this show in the past that I'm not real sharp when it comes to learning other languages. Well, it got worse yesterday when I tried to learn something to use on the air and ended up in a completely different language than I was aiming for. I was looking for the phrase for hello or good day in Finnish because we got a note from a radio hobbyist in Finland who had picked up our broadcast signal. In the process of looking at language translator websites, I ended up in Iceland, not Finland. Guess I should have turned left at Albuquerque. Okay, I've tracked down Finnish for good day. Here's my try after listening a bunch of times. All right, here we go. Hyvä päivä. Hyvä päivä. Good day, I think, in Finnish. If you're a Finnish speaker, let me know how I did. Email ideas@wpr.org. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.